28672, which is Tony Bradbury, reel 9. Now, what happened next? We're talking about your time at Lossiemouth from May 1947 and how you were in charge of a party of electricians. Now, what happens next?
Well, I stayed in charge of this part of electricians until December 47.
So nothing much happened?
Nothing much happened. It was just routine work, just servicing aircraft, repairing them.
And what was your next posting then?
Well, my next posting after that was I put in for a draft to go to sea again, like a fool. And May 48, I got a draft to HMS Vengeance.
So what happened between December and May?
Well, after Christmas leave, I contracted pneumonia and went into hospital for a fortnight up at to Ragmore Hospital in Inverness.
So that explains the time gap.
Yes.
Now, so what about your overseas posting then?
Well, I put in for this draft and saw the commander at Lossiemouth, and he said, I'll do my best for you. And very shortly after that, I got a draft to RNS Eglinton in Northern Ireland, which was preparing the air group to go on board HMS Vengeance to go to South Africa.
So when did you went there in May 48?
I went there in May 48, yes.
Now what was happening? It's RAF Eglinton.
RNAS Eglinton.
Sorry, of course.
Okay, yeah. Right.
And that's Eglinton.
Eglinton, yes. Eglinton, yes.
So it's got two G's.
No, just one.
Okay.
Yes.
Right. That's at whereabouts, near Belfast?
It's not far from Derry, actually. It's, you've got to get on the train at Belfast and go to Derry and then get a lorry out to Eglinton after that.
And what was happening? What were you doing there? How did you prepare the squadron?
Well, the squadrons were working up to go on board HMS Vengeance in about August 48 to go to South Africa.
And what do you remember of that period?
Well, it was just the routine stuff again, servicing aircraft. We got introduced to rocket-assisted takeoff gear, which I never experienced before.
Tell us about that.
Well, that was a bit of a disaster, if you ask me. Aircraft were fitted with rockets on each side of the fuselage, which was supposed to assist them in takeoff from aircraft carriers.
And what was wrong with it? Why didn't you like it?
Well, I didn't like it. Not a question of me liking it so much. I don't think the pilots liked it very much because they got a bit anxious as to know when to let the rockets off, actually. And some would actually get airborne and then set the rockets off. So that seemed a bit futile to me. And sometimes the rockets wouldn't fire. And altogether, I don't think it was a very successful experiment, really. We experimented with rocket-assisted takeoff gear, RATOG, as it was called, for about a couple of months. And then it seemed to me to be quietly dropped after that, because I don't remember it getting used on the aircraft carrier.
Now, which aircraft were you preparing? Was it?
Well, I was working on Sea Furies. I went, first of all, when I left Lossiemouth, I went on a 3-week course to Hawker Aircraft down in Kingston on Thames, and did a 3-week course on aircraft electrics there.
For the actual Sea Fury?
For the Sea Fury, yes. And we had a civilian instructor there, and I lived in civilian lodgings while I was taking the course. And I must say that the civilian instructor was very, very good, but he would keep diverting off into his frustrated sex life. So we had to recall him now and again to talk about aircraft electrics in general. But after 3 weeks, we sat an exam, and I passed that all right, so I went back to Eglinton again after that. And
what did you think of the Sea Fury?
A very good aircraft.
In what way?
It was very fast. It seemed to me to be better than the Firefly. It was more manoeuvrable, I got the impression. And the pilots seemed to like it a lot better than the old Fireflies we'd had out in the BPF.
Anything else about your time at Eglinton?
Well, just the usual routine stuff, the usual working on the hangars, repairing aircraft. Occasionally we'd get a weekend off and take a trip to Southern Ireland to reap the benefits of non-Russian goods. And
but non-Russian?
Well, Buncrana is in Southern Ireland, or was it? And as a result of that, we used to get the train at Derry, go to Buncrana, just over the border in Southern Ireland, and be able to buy exactly what we liked, which was a very strange thing for us to have. Being used to wartime rationing, it was a very strange experience.
Oh, rationing. I thought you said
yes.
Russian. Yes.
Rationing, yes.
So, what was it like? What do you remember your visits to ERA? Good?
Well, quite good, because we used to arrive at Buncrana early in the afternoon, go shopping, buy exactly what we liked, in any quantity we liked, which was quite a novelty. And the only difficulty was getting it back over the border. But the Irish people didn't seem to, the Northern Irish Customs Service didn't seem to worry too much about that. We just used to fetch back exactly what we liked. And eventually, when we went on leave, took it home.
And how did you get on with the Irish people, Northern, Southern, you know?
Well, I found them a bit strange at first. I couldn't understand what they were saying half the time. Their accent was very thick. But generally speaking, I got on quite well with them, because at the times we used to go on leave in afternoon leave or Saturday afternoon leave into Derry, we used to get go to a restaurant there, or that's rather putting it rather grandiloquently, I suppose. And
more a cafe then.
More a cafe, and food rationing didn't seem to apply there very much. Nothing like what I was used to when going on leave in London. And we used to be able to buy what you like pretty well in the way of food, and this was quite a novelty again. But the actual shortage of, shall we say, non-consumable goods was much less than it was in Southern Ireland.
Now, so anything else about it? You were there from what, May till August?
Till getting on for beginning of August, yes, when we embarked on the Vengeance.
Now, were you with the ship's RNAS personnel, or were you attached to one of the two squadrons?
We were always in a rather anomalous position. We weren't actually ship's personnel. We used to have to leave the ship when it docked, and our aircraft would go to a Royal Naval Air Station, and we'd have to go with them.
So which one of the two squadrons were you with?
Well, I seem to work with both of them, actually. I worked both on mainly on Sea Furies, but sometimes I worked on Sea Fires as well. There were two squadrons, 802 Squadron, which was the Sea Fire Squadron, and 815, which was the Sea Fury Squadron.
Now, what was your accommodation like aboard what did you think of the HMS Vengeance and generally the accommodation?
Well, between Venerable and Vengeance, in the year I'd been away from several aircraft carriers, things certainly had improved. Because on Venerable, for instance, we had no refrigerator. So in the tropics, we used to serve our batter out by the pint. But it didn't get that bad when I got to Vengeance, because they found out that I'd been mess caterer on the Venerable, How they found out, I don't know. I never advertised the fact. But they suggested that I became mess caterer again on the Vengeance, which I did. But I had a bit of trouble on the Vengeance in getting the right amount of gear.
This is the petty officer's mess, Kate.
Petty officer's mess, yes. For the air petty officer's mess, yes. Which was, again, situated the worst billet on the ship, really, right up in the bowels. But, of course, that's only to be expected, as we were constantly on and off. Obviously, the ship staff selected the best messes for themselves. I don't blame them.
And so, how did you do as mess caterer?
Well, difficulty at first, because I had to deal with a rather hostile leading hand supply assistant who didn't want to give me the necessary gear to service the catering facilities for about 40 petty officers. So I had a great difficulty. He only wanted to give me one mess kettle, for instance, and I said our allowance should have three. He said, I'm not going to give you any more. So I said, well, in that case, I want to see your supply officer. So I saw the supply officer, and he was very pusser, and looked up the regulations and ordered this supply assistant to dish out the right amount of gear to our mess, which didn't improve relations between the supply assistant and myself, but at least I managed to get the right amount of gear.
Anything else you recall about that side of things?
Well, a bit later on, I got rather, I shouldn't really say this, but I got a bit more friendly with him after that, a little contretemps. And he came to me one day and he said, do you want 100 weight of sugar? So I said, what do you mean? I said, we only get our ration. He said, well, if you see me right, I can get you 100 weight of sugar. So I put this to the mess president. He said, that sounds like a very good idea to me. So he had a whip round amongst the mess members. So I gave this chap some money. And in return, I got a bag of 100 weight of sugar, quite illegally, to put into our mess. So after that time, after that difficulty at first, relations improved with this character. And he looked after us pretty well.
Now, what about your duties on board? Anything that comes to mind?
Well, mainly preparing aircraft for daily flying routines. DIs. Just pretty much the same as at Lossiemouth, really. And previously on the Venerable.
What do you remember of the trip? You were going to South Africa, were you?
Yes. Well, what we did, first of all, we left, we embarked, I believe, at Derry, and sailed down on the aircraft carrier, came up the River Foyle. We embarked at Derry, if I remember correctly, and we then sailed for the west coast of Scotland, where we started our... We started practicing for the pilots to do takeoff and deck landings on board the Vengeance. And they seemed to be a better lot of pilots than they were on the Venerable, because we didn't have so many crashes. I've got photographs here, which I'll show you, I'll prove the point in a minute. But we went into Troon. We left Troon and went on leave at Troon as a break from the flying exercises in the Firth of Clyde. And we operated around Lamlash in the Isle of Arran, all around that area. We were based at Lamlash for a little while, and for some time we just went to sea. The pilots would take off, practice their routines, and then land on again. And that, by that time, bats them are going out, because on the Venerable we used to have a batsman who used to control the landing of the aircraft, but by that time we were beginning to get the kind of system of lights on the stern, which would indicate to the pilots if they were on the right angle to land on, and the batsmen seemed to be getting more and more redundant.
Did the pilots, was it as efficient as a method, the lights?
I think they were better, because on the Venerable, the bloke used to stand there, waving his arms around, directing them how to land on, up, down, come down, down, and then he'd make a dive into the sponson so he didn't get hit, and then he'd climb out again ready for the next aircraft. And sometimes, if they were lucky, they would pick up one of the arrestor wires, and if they weren't, they'd crash into the barrier. But all that seemed to be getting a bit better on the Vengeance, because we still had this deck landing officer, the batsman, as we used to call him, and he seemed to be becoming more and more redundant. Although we were still landing on with arrestor wires and a crash barrier if the pilot missed the lot, but the pilot seemed to be improving. So I think that it was a gradual improvement in the system of landing on aircraft onto aircraft carriers. They hadn't got so far as the angled deck by that time, or the sloping deck to assist takeoff, or anything like that. But they were gradually improving the method of operating aircraft on aircraft carriers.
Now, what else do you remember about it? I mean, so you're working up exercises off the western coast of Scotland.
Yes, and we did that for about a month, all told. That we had a brief spell at Lamb Lash. In the Isle of Arran. We also landed at Troon, had a look round the west coast of Scotland there, and then we sailed away to Scapa Flow. And my chief recollection of Scapa Flow is the remnants of the German fleet that was sunk there in 1919. They were still operating the salvage system there. There was a firm there that had the contract for salvaging the battleships that the Germans had sunk, and it was still going on to a very small extent when we arrived in late August 1948.
So what happened next? So what were you doing at Scapa?
Well, we just anchored there for a couple of days, and then we didn't go ashore there, but we just had a look round the harbour in general, and as I say, saw the back end of the salvage operations going on, which had been going on for many years, I understand. And then we sailed down the west coast of Scotland again, and out into the channel, ready to go to South Africa.
What do you remember of the journey, the voyage?
Well, it was rough in the Bay of Biscay, of course, as one would always come to expect. But the first port of call we got to Freetown at Sierra Leone, and it was still a British colony at that time, and they hadn't seen any. I don't think they've seen any many naval ships since the end of the war, so we got quite a warm greeting from the populace there. But I was rather surprised when, on first going ashore, the resident white populace seemed to be fairly well off and looking forward to entertaining us quite well. But lower down the scale, there were a few, what shall I call them, tramps almost, who, I don't know how they got there, but they would work in with the black staff on the dockside, And there seemed to be a great divide between them and the upper class, if you like. And so the upper class looked after us very well. We were well catered for in all directions, from the lowest to the highest. There, quite a few of my friends favoured the local brothels. And one incident I recall very strangely, was rather funny. One character, a friend of mine, a very nice chap actually, but he was a great friend of another friend of mine, and these two went off to the brothel. And the first one took rather a long time, and the second one got rather impatient and was banging on the door saying, "Come on, Doc, you've had your time. Get out of it. I'm on my turn now." And that's they told me this story without any shame, really. They're both very nice blokes, but they both had this need for female company, if you like. And if one took rather longer than he should have done, one got rather impatient, the other one got rather impatient and started kicking up.
Anything else you remember about Sierra Leone, or Freetown?
Well, we spent a few days at Freetown, and some of the local populace came down and took us to their homes and fed us and showed us around the... I believe the name of the place really means Lion Mountain. But they took us up into the hills behind the town and showed us all the various places they were living in. But I was rather surprised to find that their homes would get very badly eaten by ants. And I found that if they were always talking about how they had to keep fighting the ants off, and how if they would get their bed linen and furniture and all their goods rather badly eaten up by ants, and that seemed to be the main complaint of the well-to-do white population at Sierra Leone. But after a few days there, we then went off and went to St. Helena. And there, I tried to get ashore. Being a very keen student of Napoleon, I tried to get ashore to visit Longwood. But unfortunately, I wasn't able to do that. And we stayed anchored off Jamestown in St. Helena for a couple of days. And despite all my best efforts, I couldn't get ashore. But the officers seemed to be able to go quite easily, which I rather resented, because being a serious student of Napoleon history by that time, I wanted to see where Napoleon finished his time, really. But no good. Couldn't do it. But going back to Freetown for a minute, that was my first experience of male prostitution. I found that one or two of my messmates and also other people on the mess decks would be met by dirty old men coming down to meet the ship. And I believe in exchange for sexual favours, they would be granted a good meal out and would have to spend everything themselves, you see. But these particular people were known as Baron Stranglers, and they would be quite open about it. They were one or two in the mess that I was in. I said, "What are you going to do with Freetown?" "I'm going to find a Baron to strangle," they'd say. And they were quite open about it, no shame. And they would then come back and tell you that they'd had a very good evening out, and they'd had to respond to the desires of these dirty old men, And as a result, they did quite well. They'd even get some money sometimes. And that was my first experience of that sort of goings on, really. But I found that Baron Strangling was a very, I didn't really like it as a very, I thought it was a bit of a distasteful occupation.
So where after St. Helena?
Down to Cape Town, where again the dirty old men met the ship. Different sort of dirty old men, really, different people, but again, there seemed to be a few, I was thinking, lonely characters who wanted, perhaps widowers, I don't know, perhaps unlucky in love, those sort of people came down to the ship and were looking for male partners, and they found them pretty well.
Now, what was happening at Cape Town, other than that, obviously?
Well, we docked at Cape Town, and again, we were met by, first person we encountered was the Lady in White. You may have heard of her. And she sang the ship in. As we came alongside the dockside in Cape Town, the Lady in White was there. And I understand that during the war, and subsequently, she would always come down to the dockside and sing in the ship. And she sang very well indeed. And after her, there were the usual people who hadn't seen much of the Navy since the visit of George VI in the Vanguard earlier on in 1947. And they were looking forward to welcoming people from the old countries, they called it in those days. And I got in with some people who really seized onto me, I suppose, more than anything else, and took me to their home, fed me very well, took me around all the local sites, took me up Table Mountain, took me around Weinberg, all those places adjacent to Cape Town, and treated me very well indeed. And really, I felt they couldn't do enough for me. And I think the thing was that they were in the last knockings of the Smuts government. He was getting chucked out of the Smuts government, and they could see apartheid starting to creep in. And as a result of that, they felt nostalgic, and wanted to re-establish connections with the old country. And as a result of that, those people that, very respectable people, plenty of cash, although I never tried to soak them for any money, but they were very hospitable. And the people that wanted to go ashore and live with these people on night leave or weekends, something like that, they treat us very well indeed.
So what happens next? How long were you at Cape Town?
I think about a fortnight. And we went to sea a few times and had some of the military people from South Africa on board and gave them a demonstration of flying off aircraft carriers, all that sort of thing, which I believe we were following the latest practice then. And we had these people on board, and they looked around and didn't say very much, but took in all the flying practices and all that sort of thing, and then went off. Then after that, some of our people went up to Pretoria, which I believe at that time was the seat of government for South Africa. And they again had to do flying displays and that sort of thing. And a large number of aircraft flew up to Pretoria and operated from there for a little while. I didn't go to Pretoria myself, But I stayed with the ship and went to East London next. And when we sailed from Cape Town to East London, the weather got worse. And as a result of that, when we got to East London, we couldn't land. So the only people that came on board were visitors from East London, but nobody from the ship, except the captain, of course, and a few of the officers, went ashore to exchange hospitality. We just stayed at East London for 4 days, and all our visitors used to come out under very rough conditions, and